Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Fiat.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 313 for December 11th of 2015. At Mazda, the sky's the limit. Watch Autoline After Hours live at Autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific or 20 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Harry Vasilash, we're not squinting in the Arizona sun today. We're back in the studio.
Last week, there we are in Arizona, out in the desert. Here we are, back in Farmington Hills.
That's the cycle of life.
It is.
After hours. Yes, it is. And we got to let everybody know that we've got Chris Pockert with us today from CNET.
Great to be here.
And great to have you here again, Chris.
Thanks. Yeah, and you could be forgiven for thinking it's almost Arizona outside for the weather today.
It is. 55 degrees when I came in.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
Amazing.
For Michigan
Amazing.
In December, that's crazy. Mm-hmm. But what we really got to do is let everyone know we also have Robert Davis in the house with us. He's the Senior Vice President of Operations for Mazda North America. And Robert, great having you here.
Well, great to be here. Thanks, John.
So where do we start? We've got so many things to talk about with Mazda, and we've got quite a few questions coming in from our audience as well. But big year for you guys. You got the all-new CX-3 that you launched, the MX-5, the Miata, and you showed at the LA Auto Show just a couple of weeks ago the CX-9, which knocked me out.
Well, I'm glad you liked it. You know, it's the last of our sixth-generation products. It's been a really fun product to work on. The guys here in North America really spent a lot of times with our partners in Japan on that car, and it really finishes out our CX line of cars, CX3, CX5, and CX9, and we all know where those segments are going these days.
Red hot.
Red hot.
The whole market's moving to them. The CX9 would seem to me to be more of a North American kind of vehicle, simply because of its size.
Yeah, it's the biggest. The current car is the biggest car Mazda has ever produced as a passenger car, and it's the biggest car we've ever sold in the U.S. So it's North American, very North American specific, with some countries like Saudi Arabia, Russia, some of those other countries that are a little bit more like the U.S. versus Europe. But a successful car for us in the past, and we think we got the right formula for the future.
So how many passengers for the CX-9?
Seven.
Seven passengers, so it's a three-row vehicle.
Right.
And then your others are two-row.
Right, correct, Gary. It's a CX-3 and CX-5 are five-passenger, and CX-9 is seven-passenger.
Mm-hmm. And when will we see that?
In the summer. I mean, we're spring and late summer. We're expecting to begin production here in January, February, but really to get enough cars for everybody, I like to say, early summer.
Right.
And that's got your first turbo motor in a little while, right?
Yeah, first Skyactiv 2.5-liter T. It's a mouthful, but it's got an interesting driving dynamic. Instead of going for pure power output, it was really designed and tuned to have really drivable torque range. And while it's a dirty word around here right now, it really drives a lot like a diesel with a lot of low-range torque. And a lot of good usable torque that really is the driving scene that you need when you drive a three-row SUV.
And, of course, torque is what, especially in the North American market, is what people want. They may talk horsepower, if they even do that, outside of the gearhead circles, but torque is what they really experience.
Yeah, we all talk horsepower, but we all think torque, right? And when you have a car with the right balance of both, that's what we enjoy driving. And really trying to tune this motor was really specific around the scene that the end user customer will use in it, whether it's merging in the highway or a low speed to mid speed ramp up. Quite honestly, that's who drives those cars. People with young families, people that take kids to school, that's really the target customer.
Robert, you mentioned this is the 2.5 is a Skyactiv engine. Explain to us what Skyactiv is all about, because it's more than engines.
Right. Skyactiv was a philosophy we took actually before the Lehman shock, and it was really a basis of We had the challenge as a company to improve our fuel economy of our vehicles by 30%. And we gave the engineering groups a task to do that and said, listen, the sky is the limit. And so we actually decided to change the philosophy of developing our cars. In our case, our cars were always, a new car was always just a better version of the old car. So take everything old and just incrementally make it better. SkyActiv, that all went out the window. And we said, okay, let's take everything and develop it from new. So whether it was the platform or the safety strategy or the emissions strategy or even the manufacturing strategy, all was integrated and done at once, which allowed us to build the CX-5, which was the first SkyActiv model built in that kind of strategy. From there, then Mazda 6, Mazda 3, Mazda 2, CX-3, all have gone out from that same strategy. So it was a complete different way of looking at it that integrated not only manufacturing but engineering groups at the same time. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty scary. I mean, one great thing about the old system is you said, okay, I have an MZR motor, good old reliable MZR motor that I know. But pulling together a new platform with a new powertrain and a new emission strategy and all that stuff coming together at once was pretty scary, but it worked.
And it's scary because that's typically a recipe for disaster. From a timing standpoint, from a quality standpoint, cost, doing everything all new is a big roll of the dice.
We like to call them episodes, not disasters.
but for you guys, rather than being a disaster, I mean, it's almost like you guys have thrived more as a consequence of this than you did before you had that on offer.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that sometimes you don't know what you don't know, and you need something like this to be the catalyst of your business. You know, Mazda is a small company. It's not a small company in the terms of real small companies, but relative to the industry, our industry, it's a small company. And the spirit that we have back in Hiroshima is a different spirit. And actually, by doing this process and changing the way that we think about things, really kind of revitalized us and has been a real good thing for the company. It's a great company that does a lot of great things with some really talented people.
And you all have been really thoughtful and looking at what technology is necessary in SkyActiv. I mean, you brought out a new 6-speed automatic, which is one of the best automatics on the market when everybody else is doing 8 and 9 speeds, but it performs better, and because your cars are lighter, it just drives better. And you've been pretty conservative with turbos. This is your first one, and some may say you're late to the market. I would say you're more cautious in figuring out the application. But going forward, what does the turbo do within the lineup? I mean, are you looking at it for more than one application?
Yeah, we'd love to put it in more applications, but it's got to be correct. You're right. We are a little cautious, but we're cautious just to that point where we really want to understand it before we move forward with it. And I remember sitting, not in this chair, but in a lot of chairs in 2007, and you guys were asking, where's the hybrid, where's the hybrid, where's the hybrid? And in the last 3 years, we've had the best EPA fuel economy of any OEM in the U.S. So it didn't take the hybrid, but it took a lot of intestinal fortitude to say, we don't need the hybrid. You know, there's still much more to go in the internal combustion engine and the rest of the things that make fuel economy happen. The turbo gives us a good opportunity because it's with this powertrain, it allows us to package it and tune it for wherever we need it to be. Remember, the whole SkyActiv suite of technologies is scalable. So whether it's in a Mazda 2 or in a CX-9, the technology is basically scalable. And that's really why starting from scratch makes it work. People ask all the time, well, why can't Toyota or General Motors just copy it? Well, SkyActiv exhaust manifold, for example, won't fit in a conventional front-wheel drive car because it's too complex, it's too large, and it takes up too much room. So that's why you just can't take a SkyActiv engine and plop it into something that you've already got. It's got to be developed as a one common system.
That's interesting. You're designing for manufacturing at the same time.
Yeah, and for the unique things that the SkyActiv technology has to deliver. So the exhaust system is very simple, 4-2-1 exhaust, kind of used from the motorsports application. But a packaging engineer in a conventional sense would never let that happen. Oh, my God, you can't have that much room between the engine and the firewall. And then they apply the things that we all have to deal with as far as crash safety and pedestrian safety, which just then compounds it. But if that's the fundamental belief you have, then you can stick with it.
You know, but going back to your comment about the EPA and how well you guys are doing in terms of fuel efficiency, I think for people who haven't driven a Mazda lately, they might think, oh, so does this basically mean that they've made these vehicles that are very thrifty and very lackluster in right. any sense of performance at all? And you guys have managed to do 180 from that.
Yeah, just the opposite, you know, and the old marketing slogan of zoom, zoom still applies, you know, and to us, driving matters and enjoying the drive is as much about the drive as the destination. And it just doesn't have to happen. I mean, you just don't need to live in that world. And it's a nice combination to have. And again, it kind of goes along with those things about they're conflicts, but they don't need to be conflicts. So you don't have to drive a boring car to get good fuel economy. You don't have to have low horsepower to get good fuel economy. Those can be broken.
Mm-hmm. So I wanted to ask you about Driving Matters with an eye toward the long play, the future. With the increasing presence of autonomous cars in terms of people's mindset and, you know, engineering dollars and all of that, Mazda hasn't made a lot of noise in that way, and it would seem to be in conflict with the idea of Driving Matters.
Well, I think pure autonomy does. I think our strategy is to advance safety enough that it still keeps the driver in control, and we certainly want to intervene when it's necessary, and our smart city braking does that. But it's really around, again, enjoying what you're doing. So as we see the technology moving down market, primarily it's in the premium makes right now, we'll look at it and figure out what's right for us. But personally, pure autonomy I don't see is right for us, the Google solution. Certainly it's a long way from Kodo design also.
he said ever so diplomatically.
Yeah,
right. So let's talk about engines a minute. We talked about the turbo and the like. You guys have been trying to get a diesel into the U.S. market. You haven't been able to make it work. Bring us up to the speed on that, and then let's talk Wankel engine.
Okay. Wow, maybe I should stretch this diesel thing out a little bit. We still intend to bring diesel in. We think it's important for us. We're very successful in other markets around the world with diesel. And we think it's a good brand play. I mean, our cars are much more European than they are Japanese to a lot of people. And we think it's the right space for us. And looking at what's going on, the rest of the diesel market hadn't suffered from the VW situation. If I look at the sale of diesels, non-Volkswagen diesels, they've actually gone up.
Not last month. Last month they went down.
I haven't looked at it.
But you know, I think that's got more to do with gasoline prices yeah. than the Volkswagen situation. And I only say that because hybrid sales are down even more than diesel sales.
Okay. So we think it's still the right thing to do. I can't give you any update on timing, but we're working on it. And we've had meetings with our friends from the EPA and making sure that they understand what we're doing and how we're doing it. And
okay, you didn't stretch it out enough. What about the rotary engine?
Well, the RX Vision was a great success in the Tokyo Motor Show, and it's really about where we want to go long-term as a company, and rotary is certainly part of that history.
It is, but as you said, Mazda's a small company. I want to say it builds maybe about a little over a million cars a year, which is millions a lot, but not in this industry.
Right.
How can a little company like that pour so much money into an engine that seems to have very limited appeal?
Well, I think it's part of where we grew up, and it's part of where we want to go. So it allows us to do a couple of things. It allows us to use the same technology potentially for electrification and generation. The rotary engine is very good at a fixed RPM and a fixed load level and can become
so there
very
may be
efficient.
Non-automotive applications.
Right.
Yeah.
Or even electrification of our own vehicles, because we all know by 2020, 2021, that part of your fleet's going to have some kind of combined electrification to go along with it. So there's a lot of opportunities out there. From the standpoint of our resources, we've got a select group of people working on it. They're smart guys, and I think I don't know that I would ever second guess the allocation of our resources, because in the past 10 years it's been pretty spot on.
Well, you guys a few years ago showed the possibility of using the rotary engine to be powered by hydrogen, saying that basically, hey, we've got it ready on the shelf here. Do you still see that as being a possibility?
Yeah, I mean, we see the hydrogen solution, you know, similar to Toyota sees the hydrogen solution as the way to move, you know, the mechanism of electric, make it mobile. Mm-hmm. So whether it's fuel cells or compressed hydrogen, it is, in my mind, the way to make it as easy as gasoline. And at some point, we've got to get over that step. And the pure electrification guys and the hydrogen fuel cell, compressed hydrogen guys have to come together, because as long as they're arguing about it, nobody's moving as far forward as we can. But batteries still have to go a long way before they become acceptable for even 50% of the customers. Mm-hmm. So those two groups do need to get together to move the whole system forward. So, yeah, I think that's the long term. That's long, probably happen way beyond my lifespan, but that's the only thing I can see.
Robert, Mazda puts a lot of emphasis on motor racing, especially here in the U.S. In fact, I think the claim is that on any given weekend, more Mazdas are being road raced than any other brand. Is that right?
Yeah, it's my fault. Sorry.
Go into a little bit of thought, you know, how has it paid off for you guys? What are your plans going forward?
Well, in 1988, I made the mistake of stopping by the Daytona International Speedway. I was on vacation and just happened to be the Rolex 24 Daytona then. And I wasn't even working at Mazda. I was working at Chrysler and got enthralled with sports car racing at that event. And after I joined Mazda, I found out Mazda had this awesome grassroots motorsports program, along with their professional ranks, that really supported racers. They had an 800 number you could call, you could get technical advice, you could get parts. And that foundation of that grassroots motorsports support is really the reason why Mazda races. And I became involved with it. I've got a very low team membership number, but that has been the foundation of whether good times or bad of our involvement in motorsports. Since then, we've evolved into some professional ranks. We have the Mazda Road to Indy. We have the Mazda Road to 24. And it allows young people, people with a lot more talent than I have, to evolve through the system. And if they are talented, to show that talent and move up until the top ranks of either sports car or open wheel racing. That gives us a lot of pride, and it gives us a lot of lessons in what we do. For example, we took four Global MX-5 Cup cars, the first four made, to the 25 Hours of Thunder Hill last weekend and ran them publicly in a test. And they basically did three seasons worth of racing in one day. Mm-hmm. We found some issues with the transmissions of two cars, but
that's why you go racing.
That's why we go racing.
And for people at home, those MX-5s are Miatas.
Exactly. And Miatas is the most raced car in the U.S., with around 8,000 of them prepared, 8,004 now prepared for road racing.
That's pretty cool.
So I mean, this was, it's the new Miata, what, it's fourth generation now?
Yes, sir, fourth generation. It's 26 years old now, and it's closing in on a million units globally.
Mm-hmm. So John mentioned earlier that, you know, in comparison to big automakers, Mazda is a very small automaker. And some might say, why is Mazda making, you know, a two-seat roadster? Why doesn't it spend more of that money on making something else? Okay, why do you guys do it? I mean, it's a fantastic car. I mean, I love it a lot.
You know, quite honestly, I don't know why we do it. I think we do it because it's important to us. And the first car was so important and so separated Mazda from the rest of the other manufacturers. It was right, and it was the right thing to do. And the current car, I think, is as close to that car as we've ever been. Mm-hmm. I mean, So it's really tribute to the people that developed the cars and understand, you know, the Mazda-ness of it. Mm-hmm. It's a very difficult thing to describe, Gary. It's going to Japan really helps you understand it, understanding the spirit in Hiroshima and understanding the people and going to the assembly line. And I wish more people knew that spirit in the public, because I think there's a lot of people that would enjoy the products that we make beyond, you know, what we sell now.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an interesting question. I don't know that anybody can answer it, to tell you the truth. It's just, it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, if I had to ask Chevrolet, why do they build the Corvette? You know, it's kind of the same scale, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's the moral center of the brand, right? And yeah. And it fits real well with Skyactiv to me, because you pair that car away back to the essence of what it is and what it needs to be, and that's kind of what you've been doing with Skyactiv in different areas.
Yeah, I mean, Skyactiv is the modern story of the original Miata. It's the modern story of the original rotary engine. It's the modern story of when Mazda first started building passenger cars in Japan. So, I mean, it's kind of, if I take those kind of four periods in time, it's all the same. It's all done for the same reason, because there's a different way to do it, what they feel is a better way, and they execute against it.
Mm-hmm. I got to jump in here. We got to take a quick commercial break. We've got all kinds of questions from the audience coming in. We got to get back to them. But before we do that, we got to give a shout out to our friends from Bridgestone.
Hey.
Hey.
Did you have a good nap?
The Firestone Destination LE2. Tough enough to handle anything the road throws at you.
Oops.
And you throw at it. Durable, dependable Firestone tires. Whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
Doesn't show up.
Okay, we're back with Robert Davis from Mazda. We've got all kinds of questions. We asked our audience, hey, if you got any questions for Mazda, and I got to tell you, Greg Dunn sent in pages and pages of questions here. I'm going to get to one, then Gary's got some of the others, but he makes a great point, Greg does, of saying, man, do you guys have great product. You're at the top of your class in fuel economy and crash tests. You're recommended by Consumer Reports. You're named best car brand by U.S. News and World Report. But you only have 2% market share. Here's a rip-roaring, red-hot market, and you guys, your sales are up, but you're losing market share. And he asks, is losing market share a concern, and if not, why?
We focus right now on business quality. If we look at the overall industry, we participate in about 44% of what we call the industry, which was what you would relate the 2% on. So really, we're focused on our business quality. Right now, our CX products are doing great. Miata's doing great. Mazda 6 is doing pretty good. Mazda 3 is struggling. And those are segment-related activities, the C-car segment and the CD segment. That's the Fallujah of the car business right now. It's just crazy. And I've got I got Mazda 3 transacting at prices where a competitor's CD car is. And that car begins with an A and ends with an A, so that'll tell you which one that is. But so we see the emphasis being right now on quality. We're trying to get the throughput of our dealers up. The dealers are the health of our brand. So that's focused on retail. We'll have the best CX year we've ever had. CX-5 will actually outsell Mazda 3, which is a good thing. So that's why we're there. Certainly market share means something, but you got to dig a little deeper.
Gotcha. Good answer.
So we've got this CX-3 in the studio we haven't talked about. One of our viewers, Bob Roach, wants to know, why wasn't the CX-3 built on the Mazda 3 platform rather than the Mazda 2 platform, which is a smaller B-segment platform?
Because the CX-5 is built on the Mazda.
Good answer.
It really is a basis of the size and the weight and where you want to put the car in emissions category and all the powertrains. Remember, CX-3 is much more global than CX-5 and much more targeted to the European market and the Asian market, where it runs actually a 1.3-liter turbo diesel engine is the most popular engine in the CX-3, which is, again, aligned with that B B platform mm-hmm. versus C platform.
Has it surprised you how hot the B segment crossover segment is in the U.S.?
Yeah, we thought it would be. I mean, in looking at where customers are going and what they think they're or what they perceive as their value for the short term, hip point, obviously styling, the availability of all-wheel drive are all key things that are driving migration from C cars to And remember, the customer doesn't know if it was derived off a Mazda 2 right. or a Mazda 3. Mm-hmm. They don't know what B and C and all that stuff
sure.
is.
Right.
So Michael Shipley, you mentioned that there's another engine available in Europe. Michael Shipley wants to know, is there any chance of an engine with more zoom in the CX-3? So what's in the CX-3 and here and maybe what's available elsewhere?
The CX-3's got a 2-liter Skyactiv non-turbo engine here. And is also available with a 1.3-liter turbo diesel in Europe and in Asia. No other plans to make anything else available. Just to let him know, the 1.3 is not any more zoom than the 2-liter. But we're always evaluating the powertrain options. And like I said, Skyactiv allows us to be scalable. Mm-hmm. So if there's a need or a strong desire, then we can take a look at it.
Mm-hmm. So some of these are going to be a little touchy since they're about future products. Scott in Cleveland wants to know, any talk of a 929 equivalent, a step up from a Mazda 6?
No.
Okay. White wants to know, with the chicken tax effectively gone, what are your feelings on reentering the compact truck market?
Chicken tax isn't gone, but it's...
Effectively gone, he says.
It's got potential to be phased out, I think, with the...
With the TPP.
Yeah. I like it. I mean, I drove our latest generation BT50 a couple of weeks ago and drove it around for a couple of weeks. And then I went and drove the GMC...
Canyon?
Yes. Nice car. Mm-hmm. I think there's opportunity there, but I'd rather see it with the younger buyer. Our business kind of works in cycles. And when I was younger, everybody drove compact trucks, right? They were cool.
They were fast.
Yeah. But we've done a lot of research with the younger buyer, and they're not interested in them.
No.
They're just not interested in them. And I even stacked the deck. I took this BT50, put a crazy low price on it. It was four-wheel drive, all done the right way, and they still didn't bite. So maybe we have to wait another generation.
All right. Mm-hmm. Wright Knight wants to know, could more be done with the MX-5 platform, like offering a rear-wheel drive sedan that nobody else has available in the affordable class? And the second question from him, will there be a MX-5 Miata Coupe in the future?
Hmm. We don't talk about future.
Yeah. All right. You said it was going to be touchy.
Uh-huh.
But you answered the 929 like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's not talking about future product.
HTG, I pushed the MX-5 on the autocross at the Meadowlands, but failed to get it to understeer. How did you guys do that?
tell them to put a little bit more positive toe in it.
Right. Why no telescoping steering? He also goes on, why no telescoping steering wheel in the MX-5? I don't fit because my short legs mean carrying case for a head is being driven to the roof.
His helmet.
Oh.
Weight savings. Weight savings on the telescoping steering wheel. It's about 25% penalty because of the crash requirements of the transition of the energy through the steering wheel.
No kidding. I would have never known that. I love telescoping steering.
I do too. It'd be a nice option to have.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
So I've got a Greg Dunn one, but you apparently have...
I've got pages of them. Yeah, no, and they're all good questions, too. I'll truncate this. What about an RX-8?
Yeah, what about RX Vision? So.
Well, here, I'll go on to another one that maybe you can get into. He wants to know about electrification. What's Mazda going to do? And he points out, I'd forgotten about this, the capacitor-based IE-loop system, which is kind of a unique way of approaching a mild hybrid, right?
Right.
And, does this play a role in your future electrification plan?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely have to move toward electrification at some point because
by law, the
standard just gets higher and higher. And in California, there's a pure requirement. So, yeah, IE Loop's been a great way to take a step. Again, it's about incremental improvement.
So explain what that is. It's available in the Mazda 6, and it does what?
IE loop basically captures energy through deceleration and stores it in a capacitor. And it actually doesn't run an electric motor. It runs all the other electric things in your car instead of your alternator and your battery running it, thus giving the gasoline motor more capacity and better efficiency to run the vehicle itself. It's in the right front or in the left front of the car. It's a capacitor-based system that's a mild version of the system they use in Formula One racing of storing the energy and then releasing it. So it's just used for a different method. Mm-hmm. We've got a great technology partnership with Toyota on electrification. We're using their system in Japan because Japan's a little farther ahead in the number of hybrid electrics that you've got to have in your fleet. So taking SkyActiv powertrain or internal combustion technology and applying it to their electrification has been very successful. So it's just the way that we're going to go forward. And going kind of back to your resource question, by not having resources applied to electrification, by having a great partner like Toyota take care of that burden for us, allows us to do some of that rotary engine stuff.
In fact, one of your R&D guys told me that Mazda still sees another 30% efficiency that can be wrung out of the internal combustion engine. He was telling me that you guys think you're going to get to near hybrid levels of efficiency right. without all that hybrid technology.
Yeah, I mean, when you just break down the elements of where the power loss is in an internal combustion engine, it's really easy to see. And applying all the industry resources, not just Mazda resources, to those solutions, they really think 30% more is achievable.
Which is incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. So you mentioned you've got a great partner in Toyota. And as of late, you've been doing a lot more partnering, period. There's the new Miata-based Fiat 124. There's a Scion IA, which is the Mazda 2. Is there more of that coming?
Yeah, it's really based on partnerships that are product-based or regional-based, not financial-based. So we're trying to take the opportunities that are given to us with those partners to have the best relationship. Got a lot of people talking about the Fiat-based Roadster. You know, at the time that Roadster was developed, if it wasn't for a partner, we wouldn't have had the scale to do it. It's pretty easy today, you know, at 122 yen per dollar. But when that decision was made, it was 70 yen per dollar. It's a whole different environment coming out of the Lehman shock. So, yeah, I think what you'll see is you'll see small-scale partnerships where it is appropriate and where it benefits both people. Scion was an IIHS Top Safety Pick Plus, too, today. Mm-hmm. Proud of that.
That's great. Robert, we're going to have to wrap up this part of the show with you, but it's been really great having you come on here. Thanks for taking the time. Thanks for having a CX-3 in the studio with us here, too. And be fascinating to watch how Mazda does. It's so cool to see, by industry standards, such a small company punch way above its weight.
Well, thank you, John. I appreciate it. Thanks, guys. We'll see you in a little bit.
We're going to give a shout-out here to our friends at Fiat.
Amore.
Subito.
No!
The all-new Fiat 500X crossover, featuring an available Uconnect system with a 6.5-inch touchscreen and available all-wheel drive. Well-rounded, has never looked so sharp.
Okay, we're back in the studio, and this, of course, is the time of the show when we trot out Dr. Data and his numbers. So, Gary,
okay.
Let's hear it.
So, Carmen, could you bring up the first number, please? It will be here momentarily.
Oh, wait for it.
There it is.
601.
601. And it's I couldn't find anything that was 601 besides the 601. So it turns out that not this past Monday, but the Monday before this Monday, when we were on our way to Arizona, 601 was the level of micrograms per cubic meter of particulates in Beijing, okay? And so if we look at the scale of these things, Carmen, please show us the next one. So as you can see, 601 is considerably higher than 0500.
Well, 500 being on this chart here, the ultimate in hazardous.
It's
pretty much imminent death.
Yeah,
that's right.
You're inhaling soot.
It pretty much is that. So I saw that last week. I thought, wow, what a phenomenal thing that this is the level of pollution there. Well, earlier this week, and this was measured at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing. Earlier this week, they measured it at 291 micrograms per cubic meter.
So 291 would be very unhealthy.
Very unhealthy. And so basically, the government in China said factories are going to stop operating cars. We're going to reduce the number of cars on the road.
They cut it in half, right?
And so basically, through today, that they had to stop doing these things. And so apparently that this alert is something that, they're blaming on. They had a freak winter storm and they had to burn more coal. And as a result of this more coal, and there was an inversion in terms of the weather over Beijing. But, so it leads me to this whole question that, we hear about China having more electric vehicles, for example, and how do they derive their electricity in China?
Coal.
So is that going to happen? I mean, if it's at 601 and, it's beyond very hazardous, I mean, what's the future of electric cars there?
Very bright. And I'll tell you why. Because as much as China is worrying about its air pollution, as you guys just said, I want to say something like 80% plus of all electricity in China is generated by coal. Why? Because China's got plenty of coal. They've got like 100 years worth of coal. They have to import oil. Importing oil leaves them at a strategic disadvantage. So they're going to burn all the coal.
Yeah, but
that
if nobody
want.
Can breathe, I mean.
But I had a Chinese guy explain this to me in China 2 years ago who said, listen, this is a matter of national security. So they're going to talk all they want about cleaning up the skies. But when it comes to national security, they're not going to stop burning coal.
Well, and it's funny because they took half the cars off the road to deal with this crisis. But I think at the same time, they also announced new car incentives again because the market's been slowing down.
Mm-hmm. But if you look at those incentives, too, it was only for cars with engines of 1.5 liters or smaller. Mm-hmm. None of the import brands, or pretty much none of the import brands, have any cars that meet that. In fact, I want to say Ford just... rejiggered its engine there and took it from a 1.6 to a 1.5 that is in, I want to say, the Focus there, just to be able to qualify for those incentives.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you need some cardboard spacers and you're good.
Yeah. Well, so speaking of China, it was interesting that Buick announced that they're going to be bringing the Envision crossover mm-hmm. that will be built in Yantai, China, to the United States for sale. What do you guys make of that?
I think we've been expecting it for some time and probably that it would be GM. I talked to Bob Socha at the Shanghai show, I think,
Used to be
a GM.
Right, used to be a GM, but this was 4 or 5 years ago, and I asked him point blank, like, are we going to see Chinese-built cars from GM in the U.S.? And he said, well, when it would make sense. And that was an answer that got a lot of attention because it was something that people really weren't ready to hear necessarily. But here we are, just a handful of years later, and they're
coming. Look, it's in the news right now. The UAW put out a statement saying this is a slap in the face. I've heard other people say, why the hell did the American government bail out General Motors only to have it import cars from China? But put it in perspective. Number one, the U.S. imports vehicles from 12 different countries. We're used to Japan, Germany, South Korea, Canada, Mexico, but there's a whole bunch of others, including Slovakia, Sweden, England, and mm-hmm. the list goes on and on. So, of course, we were going to get cars from China. The other thing is, this Envision, which fits in between the Encore and the Enclave, will probably do, I'm going to be generous and say, somewhere around 40 to 50,000 units a year. Well, you guys know, you can't tool up a car at that price range where it's going to sit between those two vehicles. You cannot tool up a car at that sales volume. Meanwhile, in China, they're going to sell easily three times that number. So you put the American Envision sales together with the Chinese Envision sales, you're looking at least 200,000 units a year you can easily justify tooling it up. Buick needs the product right now, today. Mm-hmm. You know, if you were going to say, oh, we're only going to do it in the United States, you know, it'd be years, if ever, before they got that vehicle. So even though it's very upsetting, I predict in no time at all, this is going to blow over.
All right. So here's another data point from Stephanie Brinley of IHS Automotive, who we've had on the show. Yeah. According to Stephanie, by 2021, as much as 40% of Buick's U.S. sales will be imported from China. Another 35% will be produced in the U.S., with 20% imported from South Korea.
Well, there you go.
40% of the Buicks in 2021 from China. Think it's going to happen?
I wouldn't doubt it, honestly. I mean, obviously, that's the reason why the Buick brand stayed around initially in the crisis and the bankruptcy, was because of the strength of China. And it's making a lot of the engineering decisions. It's making a lot of the design decisions, and that's where the growth is. So that's
sure.
Where you go.
You know, what does Buick sell in China versus the U.S.? 3-1, I think, something like that. I mean, China's, just as Chris said, China kept the Buick brand alive. So, yeah, 40% sounds high to me, but Stephanie studies this stuff far more in depth
right.
than we do, so I'm sure she's right.
So do you think the American consumer will, A, know, and B, care if they know?
I think there'll be a small segment of the population that knows and cares, but they may or may not have bought that product anyway. I think the vast majority of consumers will neither know nor care.
They may care until they realize, hey, it's a perfectly good vehicle. And, yeah, most won't know. I mean, this argument goes back to, remember when Honda first built its plant in the United States to build the Accord here 30 years ago plus, and they were biting their nails. Will Americans buy a Honda made in America? Well, that was answered. No problem whatsoever. Mercedes and BMW struggled with the same issue. If we build it in America, will they buy it? And now, of course, they're shipping those products all over the world, not just building them in the U.S. and selling them in the U.S., but building them in the U.S. and selling them everywhere. It's no longer an issue. The public doesn't care.
So it's true globalization in terms of this industry.
Yeah, that's how I see it.
Yeah.
Except for, you know, some UAW members, or most UAW members, and some other people don't. Mm-hmm. Just they want the world to be like it was back in 1965.
You mean it's not?
I've got some bad news for you, Gary. But, you know, speaking of all this stuff in China and whatnot, and the pollution, what do you guys make of these cheap oil prices? And here in Michigan, we've got some, we've got some of the cheapest gasoline prices in the nation. I saw $1.69 a gallon this week. I don't know how low you guys have seen it go.
Yeah, I saw the $1.69.
Yeah, something like that last week.
And what's that going to do to everything?
Well, you know, so I didn't know this existed, but I found it today when I knew that we'd be talking about oil, that there's an OPEC website. So OPEC runs a website. And so OPEC has a reference basket of their petroleum products, right? In December of 2014, the reference basket price from OPEC was $59.46. Right now, it's $37.18. This
Yowza.
Is their basket. So it's gone down, you know, approximately 35-some%. But then I was thinking, okay, so who's in OPEC? Okay. And we just say OPEC, and, you know, we know that people in the Middle East are. But so the member countries, Algeria, Angola, Ecuador, Islamic Republic of Iran, Iraq, Kuwait, Libya, Nigeria, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and Venezuela. So I look at that and say, you know what, we better be a little cautious with these low oil prices, because, you know, those countries are in places that are tinderboxes, as it were. I don't know if it's sustainable.
That what, the low prices
yeah.
are sustainable?
And there was a guy on CNBC today who was suggesting that by this time next year, the price of a barrel of oil could double to about $70.
Yeah, and I think that's entirely possible. But the people that I've talked to that look deep into this don't ever think that the price of oil is going to go over $80 a barrel on a sustained basis. You might get a spike here and a spike there, but they're saying they don't see it mm-hmm. going at all. And the reason being is that fracking has changed the whole game. right? And the slowdown in China, but that's only temporary. The real game changer is fracking, where you can now get oil and gas from areas you never thought that was possible. And as the price comes down, it's more expensive to frack than it is to pump in Saudi Arabia. So as the price comes down, they're capping wells here in North America. But as he said, as soon as the price goes up, the caps will come off, they'll flood the market, and the price will come down again. Or what he said is we're seeing a lot of the smaller frackers go out of business, go bankrupt. The big guys come in, buy up all their assets for pennies on the dollar, thus lowering their own break-even point for fracking. Mm-hmm. And that's why he said they've studied this, and they're looking decades out. And he's saying they don't ever see it going over $80 a barrel. Hey, we're getting the sign here. We've got a phone call that just came in. Carmen, let's bring that one in.
Hey, guys. It's Jonathan.
All right, Jonathan.
New Jersey. Great show, as always. I have a question. On Autoline Daily today, you guys talked about the Corvette Z06 selling so well. They're spending, you know, $44 million expanding the plant. I'm sort of confused. I know the Corvette Z06 is an awesome car. At $80,000 to $100,000, picking up a third of the production. But I am noticing discounts on the Z06. Is it possible they're coming out with a C7 Grand Sport with a hotted-up LT1 motor with 525 horsepower to be shared with the upcoming sixth-generation Camaro? Is that what's going on, or are they really just going to produce more Z06s?
Ooh, great question.
Thank you very much. We're entering, the third and fourth year of the Corvette, and I'm a big fan, so I figured I'd ask the question.
Cool. Thanks for the question, Jonathan. Yeah.
Some of those discounts are just simply predicated on end of year, and you want to move them out of dealerships, and these guys need to get their floor plans ready for next year. So.
Yeah, but Are they discounting Z06s?
What he said?
I think they are, actually, on some level.
Well, my guess is the markup is coming down.
Right.
They're not discounting off the MSRP, is my guess.
Mm-hmm. They're still going to make money on it, and the sales are still up, so that's why they're expanding the production. So are they looking at future models? It wouldn't surprise me. But I don't think anybody's had any official word about that yet.
See, I'd love to see the breakdown, because Corvette sales are down this year. Ever so slightly, 1 or 2%. But if a third of the production is Z06, I don't think they care at all.
Right.
Because that's such an upcharge over the base model, over the Stingray.
Right.
But I who would have guessed in their wildest? I certainly would have never said Z06 would equal a third of sales.
Well, but this gets back to the previous topic. Gas is cheap,
right?
You said, and as you guys reported on Daily today, that hybrid sales are down and diesel sales are down.
Right.
And well, why is that?
I know, but I don't look at the gas pump and go, whoa, it's cheap. I'm going to spend an extra $100,000.
No, but people are thinking, well, I'll just get a new pickup now instead of, 6 months from now, and maybe I'll get the Denali version or whatever it is, and they'll spend a little bit more, and don't care about the fuel economy quite as much.
Right, at this point. And I think that has a lot to do. In terms of what Taj and the people are going to do for Corvette. I mean, for sure, we're going to see more variants. I mean, these guys are, once you have the basic tooling done, once you have that platform ready, you put in whatever you can.
But thanks for the question, Jonathan. I'm going to be asking some questions and see what's going on with pricing of Corvette and Z06 in particular.
Mm-hmm.
What's else on the list there, Gary?
Well, we had the IIHS came out with their new ratings for Top Safety Pick Plus and Top Safety Pick.
And NHTSA boosted its crash test
plan changes
standard.
To the new five-star safety ratings. Now I'm trying to remember if it was IIHS that you had trouble with previously, saying that, well, they don't really test everything and therefore you got it, or was it IIHS?
Well,
because I contacted them today and asked them what they test and how they test their cars, and they have ratings for about 190 models. We can't test every new vehicle at the start of the 2016 model year, so we ask the automakers to let us know which ones will qualify for 2016, and we test all of those.
They got a budget, man. I'm
telling
you.
We think we have an accurate snapshot of the marketplace as of December that 61 vehicles out of the 190 vehicles that they've tested qualify right now, which is pretty impressive. But, you know, it's interesting to see, you know, that Robert mentioned that the Scion IA, which, as you pointed out, is based on the Mazda 2. And so that's their little sedan. And it's badged as a Scion.
Yeah, it's stem to stern a Mazda, except they put an ugly front clip on it.
But that's the only mini car that makes it, and it's a top safety pick plus. But that's predicated largely on it having a crash prevention system that is available on that car, which is pretty amazing since it's a inexpensive car.
I want to say it comes standard with AutoBrake or something like that.
And I'm all in favor of that kind of technology. I think the other stuff that the Insurance Institute, but especially NHTSA, are talking about, more structure going into cars, I don't believe for a second that's going to have any impact on crash fatalities. I remember I moderated a discussion panel at the Society of Automotive Engineers conference probably about a decade ago. And I had all the top safety experts from all the major car companies. And I still remember to this day, the guy from BMW got up and said, we should stop investing one dime in passive safety and put all that money into active safety to avoid the accident in the first place. Because just adding more structure, more airbags, you know, better seat belts really isn't going to move the needle. Mm-hmm. Whereas the crash prevention technology is going to be dramatic.
Well, and anyway, I think that's why the top safety pick plus of IIHS is predicated on having those technologies. Mm-hmm.
Correct.
And if you don't have those technologies, then
no,
you're
and
not going to get
all
it.
For that. I think that's a good idea, but I'm talking, I guess, more about what NHTSA's doing. They're adding an oblique test. They're changing the frontal impact. You know, they're looking for more structure.
It's an improved frontal barrier crash test to drive safety improvements for rear seat occupants.
And they're putting in smarter crash dummies to collect more data. That's all fine and good. But do I really believe that's going to move the needle in reducing accidents, fatalities, and injuries? Barely. Barely.
Well, and they're already designing for IIHS standards, too, anyway, with the small front offset
and
all
this
that,
is a little bit of a race, right?
Right.
You know, NHTSA's going, geez, here's this independent institute that's got better standards and gets more media coverage than we do. So we got to change our standards.
Because that other group probably has more money. I mean,
And they can probably match that or come very similar in terms of the testing. And so they're brought into compliance, but there's not a lot of actual cost to the manufacturer to get there because they've already been, you know, working toward IIHS standards.
Mm-hmm. Well, on a completely unrelated subject, well, sort of related because it's all about it. So you guys are into Coty Jurors. So the finalists were announced this week.
Three finalist car, three finalist truck and utility.
So, Chris, tell us about these.
Well, so the pool kind of shook out kind of what I was thinking that it would. In cars, we've got the Civic, which is all new this year and kind of returned to form for Honda. Great new turbocharged engines, really good looking, very spacious inside. We were talking about the Mazda Miata earlier, lightweight,
smaller. That one surprised
me
making the list.
It didn't surprise me because there's enough enthusiasts on the list to make it there. Whether or not it has enough votes to win is something else. But, I mean, if people are voting with their heart and their enthusiast heart, you know.
That's how I voted because, you know, I want this award to appeal to as many people in the public as possible to make the award meaningful. And when you look at a little two-seat sports car, it's like, yeah, it appeals to enthusiasts. And I kept going up and down the list thinking, God, how am I going to allocate the points I'm going to vote on?
Okay, but the third one was Malibu. Chevy Malibu out.
And Chevy Malibu, right.
So.
But just going back to the Miata, I just kept coming back and going, I had a blast in that car. I looked forward to my commute. I looked forward. I can't say that with most other cars. And so I allocated points to the Miata.
Yeah. And trucks?
The truck battle is interesting, too. We've got the all-new Volvo XC90, which is stem to stern. Everything is new about that vehicle from, you know, the design language to the platform to the engines that are both turbocharged and supercharged. There's an available plug-in hybrid model. Even the owners of the company are new. You know, they no stone unturned with that car.
Yeah, who owns them?
they're owned by
Geely.
Yeah, Geely. Right.
Where are they based?
Yeah, exactly. and we've come full circle.
Uh-huh. We've
got the Nissan Titan XD. That's a really interesting play that Nissan is splitting the market between light duty and heavy duty trucks. with that Cummins engine. It's an excellent engine. It's a really interesting market play. I'm not sure how that's going to shake out for them, but it's a nice truck.
The strategy is solid. Now we'll see if it works.
And for those who didn't see us in Arizona last week with the Titan XD, which is what its name is, go to YouTube and watch John and I talk to the people that were on the team.
The people that put that truck
designers,
together.
Designers, engineers, and so on. And the final one is?
Honda Pilot. You know, the Honda Pilot had been on the market for quite a long time, soldiered on, still a really good-looking vehicle and solid to drive. They needed to do some updating in terms of their refinement and kind of move the needle in terms of design away from that blocky truck look into more of the contemporary crossover, and they've done that. I don't know that
it's bigger too.
It is bigger. I don't know that it's the most innovative vehicle out of those trucks. I think it's the least innovative, but it's a really solid package.
Mm-hmm. It really is. No, it's Honda potentially could sweep the awards with the Civic and the Pilot. I don't think that's going to happen.
I don't think so either.
My guess is going to be Civic for car and XC90 for utility. That's just my guess.
I think you're probably right. I think the Miata is a dark horse there.
It is.
And actually, the Malibu is really, really good. And it's got a great technology story. They really brought down the price point for a lot of things, like, you know, having Apple CarPlay and having Android Auto and all of those things in the center stack. Plus, you've got a hybrid model that derives a lot of Volt technology. It's much better looking, I think. It's correctly sized this time. There's a back seat that actually has class competitive space in it. It's a really nice car at a price point that matters to a lot of people still.
Okay, I got a topic, Dan. Of course, the North American Car and Truck Awards are going to be announced the first day of the Detroit Auto Show. The week before that is the Consumer Electronics Show. I'm starting to see this emerge as a threat to the Detroit Auto Show. There's going to be 115 automotive suppliers at CES. There's going to be 9 car companies exhibiting at CES. There's going to be, I want to say, 3 or 4 new car and or concept car reveals at CES. And if not for CES, pretty much all of this that I'm talking about would have happened at the Detroit show.
Okay. Let's take the 115 suppliers, though.
Yeah,
okay.
they're out of the equation.
Okay, so if we go to Frankfurt, you know, we see a hall and it's full of suppliers and lots of suppliers. In Detroit, there are suppliers. Denso's usually there. Bosch is usually there. Johnson Controls is usually there. ZF is there. But, I mean, but these guys really make an effort to be there. So, I mean, so Detroit is essentially a car show.
Correct.
Okay, so these suppliers have this opportunity to be out and show their electronic wares at CES, right? So to your point of car introduction, so we're supposed to see the production. Bolt will be there. Mary Barra is going to be making a keynote address there. Isn't it simply possible that the car companies look at this as an opportunity to talk to an audience they wouldn't get in Detroit?
I agree. No, absolutely. And that's why they'll continue to go to CES. My point is, it's a week ahead. It's literally days.
Right.
CES is just wrapping up as everyone's going to have to jump on the plane and fly to Detroit. And if you look at this year's CES back in January, Mercedes unveiled their autonomous car there. Man, did they get the media coverage, to your point.
But isn't that the place that they ought to do that, though?
Well, it is, but if you look at the convergence of technology and the car industry, you know, we're seeing more and more of that. You know, eventually the question is can you make extra noise by being there versus at a car show or whatever?
Okay, and the other difference, though, is that CES is an industry show,
mm-hmm.
okay?
Mm-hmm.
The North American International Auto Show is a public consumer show. Right.
Correct.
So in order to get into CES, you have to have industry credentials.
Yes.
I mean, or press credentials. But it's not for the
general public.
It's not for the general public at all.
Right.
So it just almost strikes me that the whole point behind CES is for technologists to talk to technologists, and then the reporting comes out of that as saying, okay, look, they have an autonomous vehicle, or look, they have an electric car.
I'm going to CES.
Right.
I'm bringing the whole crew to CES. I'm hearing more and more automotive journalists going, yeah, I'm going to be at CES. And you're going to be reporting on all this stuff, and then you go to Detroit, and I think this hurts the Detroit show is what I'm arguing.
Why?
because I think that it's siphoning product reveals away from the Detroit show. I know it's very difficult for car companies to have exhibits at both these shows. One is going to suffer. And, you know, guess what? It's the Detroit show that's suffering. You know, BMW brought their laser headlamps to CES earlier this year. They never even brought them to Detroit. So, you know, here's this really cool technology. Not a peep out of BMW at the Detroit show about it.
Well, you probably wouldn't show that technology because it's not legal on the roads in the U.S., right? You would show it to the people who would care about it in the tech sphere, but you don't want to show it to consumers because they can't buy it.
Well, but you don't have to talk to the media much or the public much about it, but you do want to talk to the international motoring press media.
Okay, except for the fact that, okay, let's use the laser headlamp example, okay? If that were shown in Detroit, okay, it would be so buried by, you know, the new styling of fill in the blank from fill in the blank, okay? At CES, which is tech focused for tech savvy consumer or tech savvy people, they're going to say, "Whoa, look at that! That's friggin' awesome, right?" Mm-hmm. And it will garner attention.
Yeah, and you know, I wouldn't have a problem with any of this if there was at least 6 weeks separation between the shows. Better 6 months, but 6 weeks. But to literally say, "Hey, I'm closing the door here at CES, and I'm going right to the airport to fly to Detroit," it's like that's too close.
I agree, and I do think it has a negative effect on the show. There's just too much, and there's too much incentive for automakers these days to portray themselves as mobility providers instead of car companies and as technology
and
companies.
You're hitting the nail on the head here, Chris, and that's, I think, ultimately where I'm getting. All this mobility services thing is threatening to upend the automotive industry to the point that it's even upending the greatest show in North America, auto show in North America. Upending is not the right word, but... And I know the Detroit organizers are hyper aware of this. I know they're doing more tech stuff at the show. They're not sitting on their hands by any stretch of the imagination. But this is a battle that doesn't look good going out into the future.
Yeah,
from my vantage point.
I would be in search of warmer Detroit weather and change the date on the show and make it a little bit easier for the media to cover. And, the surroundings would be a little bit nicer and there's more buzz about the city of Detroit and... You know, that it would be a headache for a couple of years to get the product and concept cadences right, but that's what I would do.
Mm-hmm. I don't think that's going to be happening.
No,
I don't either.
It's not going to change, Gary. No, you're right.
Well, was Robert talking about the hydrogen car will be long, in change of the date of the Detroit show?
It's out there with the
something
hydrogen
that's not in January. It's about the same time as that hydrogen car is coming out. Yeah,
that's right.
Well, hey, probably a good time to wrap this up. We can solve the world's problems on other shows as well. And we should let everybody know next week we got a fun show coming up. We're going to do our traditional Christmas presents and coal presentations where we award those who have done well in the industry this year and give lumps of coal to those who have not. And we've got something hyper special. We've got a choir coming into the studio. That used to be the official General Motors Corporation choir. GM no longer sponsors it, but I think they still call themselves the GM choir, something like that. But it's going to be very different kind of auto line.
They'll be singing Christmas carols, and we'll have Mark Phelan from the Free Press and the Scott always Burgess. Irascible Scott Burgess from Yahoo Autos.
Is he dressing up as Santa this time?
I hope that'd be hilarious.
From what I've heard from Scott, he may be very Grinch-like this year.
Oh.
So I think that there'd be a better chance of that than Santa. There's of course, there was that Grinch thing we had.
Yeah. Well, there's some changes at Yahoo this week, too. So.
Oh, there are?
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Yeah. Yeah, there are.
Well, the last time we had Scott on the show, and we had Scott was sitting here, and you weren't here, and I was sitting there, and Scott was sitting here, and Sharon Carty was sitting there, and or vice versa, it doesn't really matter. And that was like the next day he was going to be starting at Yahoo Autos. And so it was like, that's your new boss. Can we,
Hey, that's why we have after hours so
Indeed.
Everybody can get together. Okay, real quick, Chris, what'd you learn on today's show?
I learned 601, the 601 particles, for the...
PPM.
Parts per million.
Micrograms cubic liter that you don't want to... There it is.
Yeah.
There it is.
I don't want to be in that 601 because I've been to Beijing before where it's probably half that number and it's unpleasant.
Gary, what'd you learn on today's show?
I learned that Sky Active is the essence of the original Miata. I thought that was very interesting that we all sort of venerate that car and to see that this is what's behind Sky Active. That's very interesting to me.
And I think what I learned was from Mazda was that, boy, if people could really feel the spirit that's in Hiroshima at Mazda, it would attract more people to the brand. We didn't get into all that with Robert, but maybe that's the key to their marketing message. How do you create a passionate response to a brand? So that's what I learned. But anyway, with that, time to wrap it up. Thanks, guys. Good show. Want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Fiat.
Visit our website, AutoLine.tv, where you can watch us live, get your daily news fix with AutoLine Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine This Week. There's all that and much more at AutoLine.tv.